Now, what gets really interesting is when we look at this knowledge of good and evil, this duality, and we look at how consciousness may be affecting reality. We look at the atom itself. We all know from the movie What the Bleep Do We Know, from Dr. Emoto's studies on water, that thought can cause water, which is made of very simple hydrogen and oxygen atoms, some of the most simple atoms in the periodic elements scale, that your thoughts can tell the atoms in the water what to do. You know, if you think a loving thought, you know, and you freeze the water, Dr. Emoto's photos show these beautiful crystalline structures. If you think hatred, I hate you thoughts, then the water crystal, the frozen crystals are all chaotic and messed up. Well, if you go even further back to Clive Baxter's work in The Secret Life of Plants in the 1970s, he proved this concept much further back in history, that consciousness was affecting reality, that plants, when hooked up to EEG sensors, could feel our vibrations and our thoughts, and they registered on polygraphs that thought transferred into living organic material. So when we look at the atom, and what we're going to see is the exact same duality, the same pairedness, the same chaos that is in consciousness itself. When we look at the atom, we see that the atom is made of a proton and an electron. A proton is positive charged and the electron is negative charged. And then when we zoom in on the electron, we find out the electron has an anti-electron. So you have electron negative, anti-electron positive. Then when you look at the proton, which is where most of the mass energy in the atom is, it has an antiproton. And then when you go deeper into the proton, you find that the proton is made up of quarks, and quarks are all divided in dual pairs. In fact, everywhere you go into subatomic particles, you see the same duality. So the big question comes, is consciousness telling the atom what to do? Is it keeping the atom in this state? And is that code, the code that the trimorphic protonoia states in the Nag Hammadi Library, that humanity was cast to the lowest region of all matter? And what we find in that code, I mean, I'm just kind of briefly going through an overview.
No, I understand.
That the reason mass, spaceship, pilot cannot go faster than the speed of light is because of inertia. Inertia is the tendency of a body to resist acceleration. And you end up finding out that the root cause of the second inertia, the fact that we can't move faster than the speed of light, is the dual pairedness on matter itself. And in fact, the way to demonstrate this, it's really quite simple. The model that I'll give the audience is that first, look at how humanity has evolved in just travel. First, we took horses and animals and we walked or moved across the landscape in buggies and horses and walking and running. And that method of travel was very, very slow and very cumbersome. And then we invented boats and we started moving through the oceans and lakes. When a boat moves through a body of water, the propeller, which is the propulsion system on the boat, has to spin faster in order for the boat to go faster. But as the boat moves, just like if you stand in a swimming pool and you try to run in the water, you push against the water. That's the tendency of your body to resist acceleration because of the strata, the water that you're moving through. You can't go very fast through water. It takes months to cross the Atlantic. You know, when Columbus discovered America, you know, in 1492, it took him months and months to get across the Atlantic. Well, finally, we find, the birth of air flight, with the Wright brothers in Kitty Hawk in North Carolina. We find that if you fly through air mass, which is a finer strata to move through in propulsion, you can go a lot faster. You can cross the Atlantic in hours instead of months. And that resistance, that inertia, is less because the strata that you're moving through is much more, it's less dense. So, but with the problem with aircraft is the faster you go, the more that wind, that inertia, pushes on the aircraft, making it heavier in relationship to the wind. So you have to apply greater and greater force and propulsion, and eventually the craft starts to become unstable. It starts to heat up, just like the space shuttle does when
right.
It enters that dense atmosphere.
And disintegrates.
And it disintegrates. So there's a limitation on how fast you can go. And right now we can go up to almost Mach 10. You know, NASA has this little, X model aircraft. It's unmanned that can go nearly, it's like Mach 9.6. So now when you go in space, you're going into yet another finer strata. In fact, when we go into space, we think, well, it's a void. In fact, Einstein originally thought it was a void. Space was a void. And in fact, he thought, ultimately, people thought if you went into space, you could travel at unlimited speeds. And very quickly, Einstein found out that his law was correct. Even in space, the limit was just under the speed of light for mass. You could not actually attain the speed of light, and that is correct to this day. Because the faster you go, ultimately, you can go a lot faster. The space shuttle does 90-minute orbits, an hour and a half. It makes an orbit around the whole planet, which is much faster.
Can you believe that?
Isn't that incredible? 90
yeah,
minutes.
It really
an hour
is.
And a half. Now, when you get frustrated with the problems of inertia in space, you find out that the aircraft or the spacecraft is pushing on the background of space, making it heavier. You can slowly accelerate up to, nearly, if you have it really, powerful nuclear drive systems, ion drive systems, you can get up to 1/10 the speed of light, which is 67 million miles per hour. But then as soon as you want to turn out of the way to avoid an asteroid or any incoming debris, the G-forces on the turn are going to kill you and they're going to destroy your craft. And ultimately, you're going to have to turn to avoid something, especially when you get out to the asteroid belt, and then which is beyond the solar system, and then you get to the Oort cloud, which is where all the comets are, the ice comets are, which is even a bigger problem than the asteroid belt in the far reaches of the solar system. There's no way you can accelerate towards the speed of light because you're going to hit something. And then the G-forces on the turns at those velocities are going to destroy you. So when you find out that that is a problem, you find out, okay, what is the next strata? Where can you got to get out of space to move faster than the speed of light. It's kind of like, how do you get out of space? Where's this next evolution? And that's where the doorway opens to singularity. When you finally get frustrated with this enemy called inertia, and you look at these different strata, you find out, even with wormholes is almost ridiculous to me. I mean, the idea that people win great physics prizes for these things, instead of sending a spacecraft or a pilot between two distant locations, you want to move the location itself, and you want to fold the fabric of space and time, all that mass, and bend it so that it's so close to each other, then you create a shortcut wormhole to vector in between those two points.
It sounds good, David.
It sounds good on paper, but it's unattainable. And the fact that we spend so much energy focusing on something that requires the negative energy of 100 million suns for a total year, and we can't even, none of our visible nuclear fuels on this planet can ever produce energy levels, not even a thousandth or a millionth of that. Is ludicrous physics. So you have to ultimately wonder how they're doing it.